Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program Herbert Woodward Martin. He was with us last week, and we didn't really get to talk about the poet and novelist Paul Laurence Dunbar, a native son from Dayton, Ohio, who is very much connected with Herb's work. And Herb was professor of English and poet in residence at the University of Dayton for more than three decades, where he taught African-American literature and creative writing. He has devoted an equal number of decades to editing and giving performances of the works of Paul Laurence Dunbar. As I noted last week on the program, you don't hear the name Herbert Woodward Martin that often without hearing the name Paul Laurence Dunbar. And you guys are just so connected, Herb.
Yes, yes. It's almost frightening because sometimes I'm shopping somewhere and somebody will go by and they'll say, "How do you do, Mr. Dunbar?" And I'm sort of amazed on the one hand that they've made that connection, and a little bit embarrassed too that I can't leave my house without being connected with this guy that I sort of in some strange way was connected to when I was a little kid in Alabama and didn't want that association and sort of suppressed it until about 1972 when I heard Margaret Walker, the novelist and poet, read Dunbar like nobody had read him since I'd left the South. And I determined then that I had to go back and relearn the dialect and figure out what those words were on the page. And so I've been doing it ever since.
Some of our listeners are probably not familiar with Paul Laurence Dunbar. Can you tell them who he was and how the two of you got together?
Yeah. Well, he was born in 1872, and by 1906, he'd passed away. So he has a very brief life, 33 years. But in that time in Dayton, he graduates from high school, by the way, with his friends, the Wright brothers. And they have a newspaper that they ran on the west side of Dayton called the West Side Journal. And they published and printed that, with Dunbar doing much of the writing and collecting the news, and the Wright brothers publishing it because they had the machinery. And so they had this little thing going for a number of years, but then they parted company amicably, I think, because they both were interested in flying, Dunbar with words and the Wright brothers with machinery. And so they remained lifelong friends. Dunbar was the first to die of that friendship.
And he died before they flew.
Yes, yes.
He never knew about it.
No, he never knew about it. But I think he was confident that they would achieve that glory. So.
And over this very brief time that he was with us on the planet, he was quite prolific.
Yes, he wrote four novels, 12 books of poetry, four full-length plays, three of which are lost, I'm told, by the Library of Congress, and one which I discovered and finally got someone to publish it. So he was really quite busy during his lifetime, making sure that the language was preserved in interesting ways.
Herb, you alluded a moment ago to the fact that when you were quite young and still living in Alabama, that you somehow got connected with him. Was this some sort of a visual resemblance that people noted, or what was it?
I think that my peers certainly noticed a resemblance. I had the horn-rimmed glasses and everything, and they thought that I really did look like this man who was in the textbook. And I said, "No, I don't know this man, but you look like him, and you have glasses like him. You must be related, so why don't you tell him to tell the teacher not to make us memorize these poems?" And so I couldn't convince them in any way, shape, or form that I wasn't a relative of this man. So I suppressed everything I knew about Dunbar until many, many years later when I heard Margaret Walker reading him. And I had been told by Alan Tate that I needed an old guy. And when she read, I thought, okay, this man has got to be my old guy because I understand what he's doing and it makes perfectly good sense. And so from that point on, I was reading Dunbar and teaching him. And then my students would graduate. And I thought, well, I've taught them how to do the dialect and they can do it with ease, but they insisted that they could never do it and that I had to come to their schools and do the dialect for them. And so it went on and on like that for many, many years.
My guest is Herb Martin. We've had you on the program before, and you read some Dunbar for us, and this is quite a memorable experience, and we'd love to hear you read some more.
Well, I'd like to read what I think is perhaps a prophetic poem. And this poem is, we have to remember that Dunbar's dead by 1906. And this poem anticipates a leader who is not born until the late 1920s. And the poem reads as follows. He had his dream. He had his dream, and all through life, worked up to it through toil and strife, afloat forever before his eyes. It colored for him all his skies, the storm cloud dark above his bark, the calm and listless vault of blue took on its hopeful hue. It tinctured every passing beam. He had his dream. He labored hard and failed at last, his sails too weak to bear the blast. The raging tempest tore away and sent his beating bark astray. But what cared he for wind or sea? He said, the tempest will be short. My bark will come to port. He saw through every cloud a gleam. He had his dream.
Wow, so it was a prophetic poem about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
It's interesting because Dunbar is dead before he's even born, you know, and I'm thinking maybe in some ways this falls upon the shoulders of poets to be prophetic and to anticipate in some ways the future. And this poem strikes me by Dunbar that it does exactly that.
Herb Martin is our guest. So when Mr. Tate told you need to find an old guy, what exactly did he mean by that?
I think he meant that I had to have somebody in my arsenal that I sort of promoted and to keep that person before the public's eye, and that sometimes there are really some very genuinely good poets out there that don't get any attention at all, and so they sort of disappear or they fall by the wayside. And I think he was suggesting that I pay attention to a number of the old guys who had passed this way and were not gaining any notoriety or any attention at all. You know, I can think of Melvin Tolson, for one, who was very, very brilliant and was a mayor of the city out west, but very few people know him and understand his poetry. It's very difficult. It has 50 allusions maybe to one line, so you have to be aware of a whole lot of things. But that's one person.
Melvin Tolson.
Yeah, M.B. Tolson is his name. Hmm. And he somewhere comes just after Langston Hughes and in between Gwendolyn Brooks and Robert Hayden, a brilliant poet.
I remember several years ago, I believe it was Ohio University Press published a biography of Dunbar, and you were involved with that.
Yes, yes.
I read that, and there was a lot of new information about Dunbar in there, wasn't there?
Sure, yeah. I found maybe 49 new poems and was trying to get somebody to publish that, as well as the play that I had discovered had never been published before. He left it in manuscript, and that's how I found it, after looking and looking and looking and thinking, there's no such thing. He never wrote this play, and then suddenly there it was.
How did you feel when you found it?
I was just sort of, I guess I was really ecstatic and happy and joyful, and at the same time wondering why nobody had ever paid attention to this before. But I noticed in Negro Digest, first of all, that somebody had suggested that he had written some plays. But I thought, well, no one has ever said anything more about them. Where are they? And I finally located a lady in the Library of Congress who must have entered the building when it was first finished. And she said to me that she would call me back and tell me exactly where it was. And I thought, yeah, she's going to do that. But she did. And she told me that I could find it on some tapes, in some papers that had been preserved and had been microfilmed. And indeed, there it was. So when I saw the title, Herrick, I sort of held my breath, and then I scrolled through the whole thing. I didn't breathe until I came to Act 3 and the end. And then I thought, it's all here. And I was absolutely elated and surprised that it was there.
I also seem to recall that we got a look at his novels as well in this particular study.
Yes.
And I can see why the poems were what he's known for.
Yes.
The novels, some of it was kind of tough reading.
Some of it was, yeah. Because the first three are actually, I think, somebody, if I may say this, in white skin that's colored black. But the fourth one is absolutely right on target. It has genuine black characters who use dialect, who are smart people, who are very clever people, but who are caught in the midst of circumstance. The other interesting fact about this is that Dunbar was ill, and he wrote this novel in about 1 month, about 30 days. And it is the best of the four, though the other three are not bad. As he gets closer and closer to number four, mm-hmm. The sequence of telling and the plot of everything that he puts down is really quite remarkable and first rate. So
that was his mature work.
Because yes, yes.
He wasn't with us much longer.
No, not much longer. But he did over, I think, probably 400 short stories as well.
Wow.
You know, so he was really, I think he must have been pushing the pen across the paper night and day.
Herbert Woodward Martin joins us. We're talking about Paul Lawrence Dunbar, probably one of the best known poets to ever come out of Dayton, Ohio. Or would you say he is the best known?
Probably, certainly out of Dayton, the best known, and the one that is often more than not anthologized.
Yeah, we'd love to hear another one.
Well, here is one called A Negro Love Song. And if you happen not to be of that ethnic persuasion, you can always change it because and put in the right ethnic persuasion because it fits the poem. A Negro Love Song. I seen my lady home last night. Jump back, honey, jump back. I held the hand and I squeezed it tight. Jump back, honey, jump back. I heard a sigh, a little sigh. I seen a light gleam from her eye and a smile go flitting by. Jump back, honey, jump back. I heard the wind blow through the pines. Jump back, honey, jump back. The mockingbird was a singing fine. Jump back, back, honey, jump back. And my heart was beating so when I reached my lady's door that I couldn't bear to go. Oh, jump back, honey, jump back. I put my arm around her waist. Oh, jump back, honey, jump back. I raised her lips and took a taste. Jump back, honey, jump back. I love me, honey, love me true. Love me well as I love you. And she answered, 'cause I do. Jump back, honey, jump back.
Herb Martin reading Paul Laurence Dunbar. I've heard you read that poem a number of times. And how many times do you think you've read that particular poem?
I can't imagine now how many times. But it has a nice kind of rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it almost reminds you when the refrains of a little bit of rap. And that Dunbar is anticipating these people, and how fast can you read this, and how fast can you say it? So he really had a sense about what he was seeing and what he was hearing.
Mm. Yeah. And you also have a new collection of your own poetry out called On the Flyleaf, and we had you on the program last week to talk about that and to
yes.
read some poetry from it. And you were kind enough to return for an encore this week, because last week we didn't get to Dunbar, and
nope.
and there's so much there.
Well, yes, there is a great deal there, and I'm working with another person right now to reissue as many more of the 50 poems that I found, the 50 poems that Joanne Braxton has found. And in recent months, I think the new editor that I'm working with has come up with almost 20 more poems. So we are finding pieces that are out there just languishing, waiting for us to put together with something like a definitive volume of Dunbar's collected poems.
Now, where do you find a lost poem? Is it in a letter? Is it in an old newspaper? Where do you find them?
Sometimes you find them in newspapers. Like I found three in the Denver Post, I think. Yeah, that's right, Denver Post. And they were published just around the end of Dunbar's life when he went to Colorado to get better from tuberculosis.
Yeah.
He published them, and they just stayed in the newspaper, and no one has sought them out. So my new collaborative colleague has gone through every biography and noticed all the poems which have been mentioned, and then has put in that title into the search engine, and sometimes it comes up with the poem, and it comes up with where it is in what particular journal. So Dunbar was sending things out very much like I did, and getting them into interesting journals. One of the other curious things that I don't think happened to anybody else but did to Dunbar is that if a editor liked a particular poem and liked only, say, maybe two verses out of a four-verse poem, he would take those two verses and then put a new title on it and publish it with Dunbar's name. So I found in a number of places that that happened to Dunbar, but I don't think it happened to anybody else. They just took great liberties when they wanted to.
And he might not have even known about
it. No, he may not have known about it, but I found a number of poems where I've had to put back two stanzas with two other stanzas and corrected it.
So it's almost a form of poetic archaeology.
Yeah, yeah. You have to look and keep looking and search. If somebody in a newspaper article mentioned that he had just written a poem, that poem may not have gotten into his collected edition, which came out in 1913, and so has languished somewhere in somebody's archives.
I, of course, recall going to the library and going through the microfilm of all the old newspapers. Has this stuff been digitized?
Some of it has been, but a lot of it hasn't. It's just a matter of who is working on what right then and there in a particular journal or in a particular group of newspapers. Mm. But you still have to somehow let the fingers do the walking, and you have to go through a number of volumes in the library. You just have to put your hand on these things and search for them, and sometimes it will yield pure gold.
Herb Martin joins us. We're talking about Paul Laurence Dunbar, and you've been kind enough to read some of his poetry. You're very much associated with Dunbar, I think, in the minds of many, as you stated. You're in the grocery store. And do they really think you're Dunbar?
Yes, I think I still look a little bit like him, though he never got to be my age. So, but that resemblance is there. And sometimes when I'm reading, say, in a grade school or a high school, the kids think that I really am him in some kind of way. Uh-huh. And it's something that I can't erase. And so I've just given up on it, and I just go with the flow now.
So you don't believe in reincarnation then? I'm just kidding. We'd love to hear another poem.
Well, let me read you Dunbar's most famous poem. It's the one that gets anthologized the most, and it is in standard English as well. We wear the mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts, we smile and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but O great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but oh, the clay is vile beneath our feet, and long the mile, but let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask.
Herbert Woodward Martin reading from the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar here on the Book Nook today. And Herb was kind enough to do two shows in a row. So if you missed his previous appearance when he read from On the Flyleaf, that will be posted as a podcast on the website here shortly, so you'll be able to listen to that interview as well. Herb, when you made this connection with Dunbar, did you realize that so many years later you would still be doing this?
No. I just thought it was a kind of a flash in the pan. You know, it's something that you can't possibly have anticipated it. And I could not have understood anything about the future, nor anything about how my peers in the South connected me with this man and how he would come to be so influential in my life. I remember when I did the Dunbar Centennial in 1972, and somebody else did it in the same year in California. Mine was first, his was second. And I finally began to think Dunbar was somewhere up in the clouds looking down, and he looked down and says, there are two Martins, one's named Herb Martin and one's named Jay Martin, and I picked them to do my centennials. And I think that in some ways that he had his hand on us and forced us to do these things that we never would have thought of on our own.
So when you did the centennial, were you at UD?
Yes, okay. I was at UD. I'd only been there a year and a half, and I walked into my office one day just exhausted from teaching. I was teaching the African-American Lit course, and I threw the book on the desk, my desk, and it opened. And I looked down at it and said, Paul Laurence Dunbar, 1872-1906. And I thought, my goodness, in a year and a half, he would have been 100 years old. So why don't I have gather all the poets of my generation that I know who would love to come to Dayton and have a reading? And so we had four novelists and 18 poets, one actress and three or four critics. And they all sort of descended on Dayton, and we had three long days of just reading Dunbar and then reading our own works.
Wow.
And promoting Dunbar.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And you can thank your mother for making you stay in Dayton.
Making me stay in Dayton, yes.
I think we have just enough time maybe for one more. Do you have another one picked out that
okay.
you'd like to read?
This one is in dialect. Dunbar moved back and forth from dialect to standard English, and so I do the same. This is called Opportunity. My granny is going a-visiting. I seen her get her shawl when I was hiding down there behind the garden wall. I seen her put her bonnet on, and I seen her tie them strings, and I's a-gone to dreaming now about them cakes and things on the shelf behind the door. Mercy, what a feast. Soon as she gets out of sight, now I can eat in peace. I've been watching for a week, just here for this here chance, and when I gets in there, I is surely going to dance. Lemon pie and ginger cake. Let me set and think. Vinegar and sugar, too. Now, that's going to make me a fine, fine drink. And if there is one thing that I loves most particularly, it is eating sweet things, honey, oh, and drinking sangria. Lordy, won't poor Granny rare when she see the chef. When I thinks about her face, I'm most ashamed of myself. Well, she is gone, and here I is back behind the door. Oh, look her here. My granny suspected me. There ain't no sweets no more. Every sweet is hid away. Job is done up just brown. Person would have thought that somebody thought that there was thieves around. That just breaks my heart in two. Oh, how bad I feel just to believe that my own grandma believed that I would up and steal.
Herb Martin reading Paul Laurence Dunbar. I love that poem.
It's a great poem. It is.
Wow. Well, it's really been a pleasure having you come back for an encore.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and it's been my pleasure to do this.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Herbert Woodward Martin. He's been sharing some of the works of Paul Laurence Dunbar with us on the program today. He was with us last week talking about his new collection of poetry. It's called On the Fly Leaf, published by Bottom Dog Press out of Huron, Ohio. Part of the Harmony series, Dunbar series.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
That guy gets around, doesn't he?
He certainly does. He certainly does.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week when Olin Steinhauer returns to the program. He is considered by many to be an heir to the espionage legacy of Jean Le Carré. His new spy novel, The Cairo Affair, is quite a thriller. And coming up in 2 weeks, we'll have a memoir for you. Megan Husted wrote it. She grew up in a missionary family and lived all over the world. It's called More Than Conquerors, a memoir of lost arguments. That's the Book Nook. Coming up in 2 weeks. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.